Today's January 29th, and due to the tardiness of myself, Representative Nancy Dahlstrom, we are starting at 1:05 instead of promptly at 1. Just got out of a good ethics review that I know many of you were in. Today we are going to adjust our schedule just a little bit from what some of you may have previously heard. The first bill that we are going to take up today is House Bill number 271, which is a bill from Representative Hawker. And so I'd like to invite you to the table. And for any members that may have forgotten, Representative Hawker is chairing a committee that starts at 1:30. So what I'd like to do is have him give his overview, ask any specific questions of him so that he may go to his next assignment and start on time, as they always do in finance. And then we have Julie Lucky, that I understand is able to be here with us to answer questions, as well as other folks. So with that, if you'd please proceed. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Judiciary Committee, for your record-keeping purposes. I am Representative Mike Hawker. I represent District 32 in the Greater Anchorage area. I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to have this bill heard by your committee today. The motivation behind this bill is responding to concerns raised by many of my constituents on a very profound and very important topic, and that is drunk driving, and particularly the damage caused in the community, unnecessary deaths caused by repeat drunk driving offenders. And I think I would just offer as a premise that drunk driving, from the standpoint of its danger and its willful, the willful nature of it and the danger it poses to the community, is not really an awful lot different than firing a gun into a crowd. You may miss everyone, but yet you may kill three people, and you never know quite where the bullets are going to land. We in my community of Anchorage, and specifically where it comes from, the interest of my constituency is I have the Seward Highway runs the length and breadth of my district, and the Seward Highway has clearly seen some very tragic and very high-profile accidents again this summer. Several years ago, we did, with the help of this committee, pass the highway safety corridor enforcement bill, which has been tremendously successful in reducing rates of fatal and injury accidents on that highway. But when you throw drunk driving in there, no matter how much you patrol the safety corridor, otherwise you've just got, again, you've got gasoline and you got a match. Constituents that I represent, particularly in Girdwood, that commute daily back to Anchorage, fear for their lives driving on that road for the few irresponsible drivers. And as you know, perhaps evidenced most tragically here at the shortly before session, I believe it was in November, we had the case of a repeat drunk driver who had another extraordinarily tragic accident on the highway in South Anchorage. I can tell you folks, as you all know yourself, my telephone line starts, every time there's a headline, my phone starts ringing. So I bring before this committee a request to think about what are we as Alaska policymakers, what can we do, what do we want to do, what are we able to do, and what are we willing to do? And the bill before us manifests two specific requests that we've received repeat comments on in our office. I'd offer it to you as the committee, and Madam Chair, I don't expect to see this bill move today. This is a very complicated issue. It involves all of the various public safety agencies. It involves us having to have financial considerations and balance those against the public safety considerations. So, again, hoping to, again, starting the dialogue here in the legislature. The bill before us addresses two issues regarding to repeat drunk driving, where for second offense issues, one of the areas where I think there is a weakness disclosed in our current drunk driving statutes is that when one has been stopped, arrested, processed for a drunk driving offense, you get through the processing time frame, you go to the impound lot, you pick up your car, and you drive away again. concern there is that there's we don't have the protection of, for say, the interlock devices. And we had a lot of requests from our my constituents to make interlock devices mandatory from the moment one has been arrested. So the first part of the bill requires that any vehicle being removed from, number one, it requires the court to mandate an interlock device by anyone that is being processed, arrested the first time for a drunk driving offense. And secondly, it requires that any vehicle that has been impounded, if the offender is the owner of the vehicle, it must be equipped with an interlock device before it's released from impound. And secondly, and it's a big part of this, and I offer it to the Judiciary Committee for your consideration and counsel, is, as folks know, we've got a schedule of penalties for drunk driving. First offense is one thing, then the second, the third, and the fourth offense. What we've done here is bump that fourth and third offense criteria basically up a notch, taking the existing penalties in law, but instead of applying them on the third and fourth time, we're applying them on the second and third time. So that's really the substance of the bill. Certainly very much welcome the thought and counsel from the Judiciary Committee here on, again, what it is we can, what we ought to do, and what we will do in the state to provide additional protections against repeat drunk driving offenders. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Before we proceed, I was remiss in stating for the record, although I'm sure that Susan has already corrected my mistake, that present we have with us Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Heron, myself, Chair Dahlstrom, Representative Holmes, and Representative Gatto. And thank you very much. Anyone that might have come in late and missed the information, Representative Hawker needs to leave in approximately 10 minutes to chair his meeting. So if there's any members of the committee that have questions specifically for him, now would be a good time to do that. Otherwise, we'll proceed with testimony. We have other people. And I will not be planning on moving this bill from committee today. There's a couple people that I see that are or departments that are not represented here in the audience. I know we do need to hear from also. It's a very complex issue, very serious. We need to deal with it very, very thoughtfully. So with that, are there questions from members of the committee? Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hawker, we started several years ago trying to get drunks out of their cars. And the background seemed to indicate that more money and longer sentences didn't do it. They didn't have the money, and they got to meet new drinking buddies in jail. And we're having the same or similar rates of DUIs. But what did work was the interlock, and we already have that now. Another thing that does work, and this is through research again, is, and I've prepared an amendment for it, is that according to other states, if you do jail time on the day you were arrested, you don't get to have somebody else drive you home, you don't get to take a bus or a cab. You do jail time on that night. That is also another way to reduce DUI offenses. And I think it's probably, I don't know what the cost is. I don't have a note on it yet. But I did see that your note was about $7 million. And I shudder at those prices. And what I'm curious about is whether or not, I guess I don't know when you get your money's worth, when you save one life, when you save more than one, when you save one a year. That's all valuable information. But since you might not be here, I will offer the amendment, and we'll debate it here, and we'll chair can act on it or not act on it. So that's just because you're leaving. I wanted you to know that that was a plan. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And on the amendment part, my preference is that we won't entertain any amendments today, because I believe that after this discussion that possibly there may be some more generated either from the maker of the bill or the departments that are represented or us as members. So I think that's the most productive way to do that. Any other questions for Representative Hawker?
And if I might respond, Madam Chair, just a couple of quick thoughts. And thank you, Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative Gatto. and other members of the committee. I really do view this bill as a work in process. I have brought it here specifically to invite the reformation, the evolution of this bill into something that works for everyone. Now, the interlock, I believe the statutes we have in place are interlock mechanisms that are available in order to recover your driving privileges after you've been convicted. In this case, we are imposing interlock requirements pre-conviction. So it is definitely a different element. The immediate incarceration amendment, in all honesty, I'm just coming off the top of my head, but you'd have to check with the professionals behind me. But I believe that we have I think it's an immediate incarceration, but again, the folks behind us can explain that. And you asked about the price of a life, and I would offer to the committee, it depends whose life it is.
And who's setting it?
Do you wish to comment on that, Representative?
No, I'm fine.
You're thinking? Okay, no problem. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with your permission, just more of a comment than a question while we have the bill sponsor. It's been a tough year across the state and particularly in South Central and in your district. But, of course, many of the people driving through your district are from my district or other districts throughout the state. And I know we spent a lot of time over the summer. There was a Judiciary and Transportation Committee hearing held just trying to figure out what we can do, particularly on that Seward Highway section. And as somebody who drives that section of highway frequently, I'm nervous now every time I get on that highway. So I don't know what the fate of this particular bill or any particular section of this bill or other bills that I know you and others have introduced. But I do thank you for bringing the bills forward because this is a really important issue for us to be discussing.
And thank you very much, Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative Holmes. Thank you. And I was also reminded just here in the whole context, this bill makes the second offense a felony. Second DUI incurrence a felony, whereas currently we have two passes before you go felony, and from the standpoint of the ceasing of stopping getting people off the roads, a felony conviction has a lifetime revocation of driving privileges. So, again, this is no small matter to be imposing on the community either. Thank you very much.
All right. Any further questions? All right. Thank you.
No, I have questions.
For Representative Hawker?
For Representative Hawker,
great.
Yes.
Please
thank
proceed.
You, Madam Chair. Have you had any legal opinions on this? Have you received any from Ledge Legal?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunberg, no, we have not taken this to Ledge Legal.
They didn't draft this?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, it was drafted through Legislative Legal.
Have you received any formal or informal opinions on the constitutionality?
Do we have one in the... Madam Chair, I would defer that to my able...
Thank you. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Julie Lucky, and I am staff for Representative Mike Hawker. Madam Chairman, Representative Grunberg, we did not have a legal opinion regarding the constitutionality of the bill. I have had some discussions with our legal drafter. However, I would say there is no definitive answer. I think that we do have some people from the Department of Law. I hope they are here. We did request that they were here to discuss that issue further. At the time, there was some discussion about whether or not we could do the interlocks prior to conviction.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked for a formal opinion, but our legislative legal did not actually send us a formal opinion. I don't think that I'm not sure if there was a, after hours of discussion, I don't know if there was a definitive answer from our legislative legal department. I was hoping that that was something the Department of Law could speak to today during the hearing.
Was that Jerry Lockup you talked to?
Madam Chairman, Representative Grunberg, yes.
Okay. Do you know, is he preparing an opinion at the moment? Do you know?
Madam Chairman, Representative Grunberg, I'm not sure if he is preparing a formal opinion. We had had some discussions about it, but I can request an opinion in writing.
I'll talk to him.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions for Julie while she's here with us?
I just would have but one follow-up, please.
Sure.
yeah, that was the thing that concerned me initially, whether you can constitutionally require something that would be an element of the punishment phase before they've even been charged. And I have some serious constitutional questions on that. Were there any other constitutional issues that you and Mr. Lockup discussed?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, there were not. And it's my understanding, I have some background information, that there are some other states that require interlock before conviction. I'm not sure if they are on the first offense. I'm trying to get the information on that. I do not know if there has been a constitutional challenge on those yet, so I'm not quite sure if it's gone to court, but that's information that I'm trying to research now and can bring back to the committee as soon as that's available.
How about, through the chair, how about on the other issues where you're increasing the punishment, specifically whether for a second DWI there are any constitutional issues about permanently revoking a person's license? Has anybody looked into whether that's cruel and unusual punishment?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, we hadn't looked, that was not brought up by our drafter as a problem. I'm not sure if that might be brought up today. We can definitely get some information on that. There are also some states, I think the Virgin Islands and some states do have a second offense felony conviction, and I am not sure if that has been challenged at this time, but we are trying to get the research on that.
And if I may follow up, any other constitutional issues that you have discussed or has anybody discussed or raised with you?
Madam Chairman, Representative Gruenberg, I haven't discussed any and none have been brought to our attention at this time.
I'd appreciate it if, while this committee has jurisdiction over this bill, if any other constitutional issues are raised, and I don't mean frivolously, I mean just that there's some basis to them, that you'd let the committee and me specifically know, because we need to know anything that we're possibly looking at when we pass this and any other piece of legislation. I'm going to ask people regularly the same questions. I don't want you and your boss to think that I'm singling you out. You just happen to be the first bill out of the chute.
And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chairman, Representative Gruenberg, I know that the sponsor's intent is to have as honest a discussion as possible on the record, and I don't know if there are frivolous constitutional questions, but any questions that are brought to our attention, I will be sure to put on the table as they come to our office.
Yeah, when my kids come home, we discuss frivolous constitutional issues, generally relating to them.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more question just to put out there. I don't know, Julie, whether you might have any information or maybe some of the other people who are going to testify. Is just if we have any sort of factual or statistical information, whether people actually are drinking and driving during the period between when they're arrested and when they're actually go to trial. I have absolutely no idea. So trying to get a scope on how many people this might affect. It looks like the bill sponsor's waving his hands.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Representative Holmes, be absolutely honest with the committee, that sort of analysis did not enter into our consideration of this bill. The bill is I'm bringing forward as a legislator representing my community, mm-hmm. requests that they made of me because they feel it's important and they feel threatened.
Thank you. And I think, I stated earlier, this bill will not leave committee today. It may not leave committee next time or the next time. We're going to work on it for quite a while, and the issues that have been raised, the constitutional issues that you raised, are all very valid. The maker of the bill has commented on them. Some of them you missed before you came in, but I know you were in the ethics training. His concern is that this is done right, that we take a good, long, hard look at it, that all the departments that are affected, we know there is a huge fiscal note that would go with it. You know, we're going to have to make some tough decisions. The value of a life, as has stated before, or the value of one's life if they're crippled for the rest of their life, or the effect on those that are left when one loses their life, those types of things. Choices and consequences. We're going to have to make some tough decisions, and it's going to entail some potentially really emotional conversations in here, but this is the correct place to do it. So we welcome that. We are happy that you have brought this issue forward. Again, as Representative Holmes has stated, this has been a statewide issue, and all of our constituents travel down that road in your area because it is so beautiful. So with that, I want to thank you and allow you to be able to chair your committee on time. Is it something that can wait, or?
Well, it's kind of a procedural thing.
Okay.
And normally I wouldn't do this, but it's an important issue that Representative Gatto has raised. And I guess I'm going to make a request to the chair.
Okay.
Since he's got this before us, so that we know what we're going to be discussing next time around, I'd appreciate it if it could be numbered and formally put before us, and we hold that so we have this before us and we know we're going to discuss this at the same time, if that's okay.
And just so I understand, what would you like numbered?
Amendment number one.
Oh, let's,
If he's going to do it. So we don't have this sprung at the last minute. We know
it may not be, the amendment that was mentioned may not be amendment number one. There are several amendments. There are several amendments that are forthcoming, and I'm quite confident you'll have one too. And,
no, I don't know that I will.
So,
thank you for suggesting.
We'll number them accordingly. So thank you very much, and good luck in finance.
Thank you, ma'am, Madam Chair. And again, three members of the committee, and Representative Grunberg particularly. I really do appreciate the spirit of the conversation, and again, with a certain, the lightness in which we can approach this, I just emphasize, it does not reflect our concern about the seriousness of the problem, but the absolute open dialogue here is, I can't tell you how much I appreciate and solicit your input, sir.
Yeah.
All right,
thank you.
Thank
you, ma'am.
Thank you. We shall be seeing you again.
We're going to go play with numbers.
That's why I said good luck to you.
Have fun.
So I have, on this particular bill, we have four people who have signed up to testify. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify that has not signed up? I see Department of Law here and Department of Public Safety. I would love to have Commissioner Masters come to the table if you would be willing. Wonderful. Even though we know you, please.
We signed you up.
Please identify yourself and your affiliation for the record, and then proceed. Thank you.
Madam Chair. First off, I did sign up and said yes on the, on the list there.
I apologize.
No, that's fine. For the record, my name is Joe Masters, and I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. And I am very happy to be back in front of this committee again. Wanted to offer a couple of thoughts. We haven't had a lot of time to review and digest this bill as of yet, but certainly the issue of highway safety is one of the priorities for the Department of Public Safety. As a matter of fact, it's one of our three priorities for this year. Two of them you've already heard before, and that is rural law enforcement and sexual assault and domestic violence, and highway safety is third highest priority. So this is certainly an important issue to the department, and although we cannot sit here, or I can't sit here and give you a recommendation regarding our thoughts on the bill, I can say that I certainly appreciate that Representative Hawker brought this bill in front of the committee for a review, because I do think that the issue does deserve some very serious attention from the committee as well as the public at large. And I was able to look at a couple of statistics that outline just in a real concise manner some of the issues that still exist. Currently, we're arresting about 6,300, and the number comes up and down a little bit, about 6,300 people a year for DUI. And if you just do a quick note of math in your head, that's almost 1% of the population of the state every year. Mm-hmm. So there's still a considerable problem with driving while intoxicated in the state. What we don't know is how many people we're not catching. Mm-hmm. We know that we're catching 1%, and I believe the Representative Hawker's analogy of shooting a gun in a room is actually pretty germane here as well. We don't know how many shots are being fired in that room, and every single one of these incidents of DUI is a potential wreck. Either a fatal wreck or a serious wreck or a non-fatal damage only wreck. Either way, there's potentials for crashes in these situations. As far as of these arrests that we're currently making, what do we know about the percentage that make up DUIs? In 2007, 43% of DUI cases fatal crashes were alcohol-related. In 2008, 45% of them were alcohol-related. In 2009, 25% of the fatal crashes in the state were alcohol-related. We also took a look at, or did a preliminary look at, the number of crashes in the state compared to the number of repeat DUI offenders. And I think this would be interesting for the committee to know. In over a 10-year period of time, there were 44,238 crashes. 454 were fatal, 8,888 were injury accidents. Of that, 2,900 of those drivers of these crashes were multi-DUI offenders. And to break it down more specifically, these 2,900 drivers or offenders were participative in 92 fatal crashes and 1,024 injury crashes.
Commissioner, there's a question from Representative Gatto.
Commissioner, I'm going to ask this question now, so maybe your sewer staffers can look into it. We are also handling legislation on sexual assault, domestic violence. And I'm just guessing that the same people who are committing DUIs are committing sexual assault and or domestic violence. And so if there was a way to put the databases and compare them, see if there's a number of people that just seem to be in both of them. And I know you not something you're going to be able to know right here, but if there's a chance to find it out, I think it'd be informative.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, we certainly will look at that, and knowing the capability of the systems as of today, I don't know if that is possible, but we will certainly take a look and report that back.
And Representative Gatto, I'm assuming you're asking because of the alcohol connection, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And then those statistics, Commissioner, are you able to give us a copy of that so it can be in the bill packet later on?
What I would like to do, Madam Chair, if it's okay, is I'd like to get this put into a little bit nicer, cleaner format for you.
That's perfect. Mm-hmm.
And
thank you.
Year by year breakdown.
Thank you. All right, please proceed. Thanks.
Okay.
Good idea.
And if I could also just say that we have online Lieutenant Rodney Dial.
Yes.
And he's available to answer questions regarding some of the more technical parts of the bill or the impacts that they may have on the practicality of applying it from a law enforcement perspective.
All right, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. I don't know if this is for you or the Lieutenant Commissioner, these interlock devices, at least in the past, have not been available all over the state.
Right.
And how is this going to work in places when they're not available?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, actually, that is a question that would be wonderful for Lieutenant Dial, and he's actually started doing a little bit of research and thought on that exact topic.
Could he answer, Madam Chair?
We'll present a problem.
We'll go straight to him after the commissioner. Yes, Representative Herron.
Thank you, Commissioner. Leaving the devices aside for a minute, but I was interested to hear that 29 in your annual number, 2,900 are offenders who have previous convictions. And so that's a staggering number. So I guess these proposed legislative fix work. But getting down into refusal. So as in your career, you've had to do that. Refusal because they were way too drunk, or were they refusal because they weren't drinking but they were impaired in other ways? Was it because they thought that if they didn't take the test, there somehow their lawyer is going to get them off? I'm not asking you to define it legally. I'm from a working trooper or a working police officer on the street. What would this do, given this section 3?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I can give you a little bit of perspective from way back when I was on the street. That was certainly a number of years ago.
I'm sure things haven't changed.
I certainly can comment that, in my experience, it was extremely rare for me to come across an instance where an individual refused to take a test, where, in my opinion, they were certainly intoxicated. And I believe your characterization of some of the reasons that they may give for not, or there may be for not submitting to a test are accurate. As far as specific application on Section 3 of the bill, I think if you don't mind, I'd leave that to Rodney Dial.
Oh, Lieutenant thank Dial. You. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Lynn.
What's the typical DUI test that you give? Is it blood? Is it the mask? Or what do you typically do? It may depend on where you are and what's available, but...
Through the Chair, Representative Lynn, just real succinctly and more detail probably should come from Lieutenant Dial again, as he's a more recent expert in this. But generally, an individual is stopped, there's odor or some visible indication that there is alcohol or drugs impairing the driving, a set of field sobriety tests or a battery of sobriety tests are given, which, you know, and I haven't given that battery in a number of years, but generally there's a walk and turn accounting or those, and those type of tests, I believe Lieutenant Dial could probably more specifically articulate. And on probable cause, after arrest, there is a submission to the breath alcohol test.
I know that on the scene, but when you come back to the station, since I used to do this, it was a long, long, long time ago. you know, you did the test out in the street, the walking, the counting, the nose, etc. Then you come back to the station and you get another test, and usually one of the blood tests. In those days, it was they just put a mask up like that, and they would do that. Maybe probably have better equipment now. I'm just curious. I know that a couple of times somebody would refuse to take this test, and we would restrain them and say, well, you don't have to take the breath. We hold the mask up here, and it's your choice whether you want to breathe or not. You just hold there long enough.
Through the Chair, Representative Lynn,
I
really want to defer to Lieutenant Dial on this, because I don't think I've arrested somebody in maybe 8 to 10 years for DUI myself. So.
We'll be sure, and we'll ask Lieutenant Dial about that. All right, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I was wondering if you had any statistics for us. I'm trying to understand. I'm looking at the breakdown or the sentencing for, you know, your first DUI, your second, your third, your fourth, your fifth, more than five. Of repeat DUI, I would assume there would be a universe of people who get one DUI, learn their lesson, and don't reoffend. I'm kind of wondering how many people would fall into that category. How many people get a second and not, I mean, are people getting one? Are they getting two? If they get two, are they just as likely to end up with five? Where are the numbers there? Do we have a handle on that?
Representative Holmes, you know, I have not seen a specific breakdown in that fashion. There certainly may be one, and it may be something that we can get if it's useful to the community. I do want to assure you all that my purpose for being here is I wanted to very firmly state that, you know, this is a very big problem in this state still, mm-hmm. and that it's a big issue for this committee to deal with, and you're going to have a lot of deliberation over the issues, and it's our commitment to provide you whatever information we can possibly provide you to assist you in making these decisions.
Thank you. Thank you. We appreciate that, and you've always been most helpful, and all your employees, in getting us that information. So why don't I, if you wouldn't mind, stay there, and we'll go to Lieutenant Dial next in case he defers to you.
May I say something?
Sure.
I just want to echo that. I personally very much appreciate the way you've conducted the office in your own position since you've taken over, and I just wanted to put that on the record. I hope I'm speaking for the folks on my side of the aisle on that. But we really appreciate you.
Through the Chair, thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Lieutenant Dial, are you with us?
Yes, Madam Chairman, I am.
Welcome. I feel like you're an honorary member of our committee. We can get you a permanent chair here.
Very much.
Just for the record, if you would please identify your name and your affiliation, and then if you would proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with Alaska State Troopers, and I currently assist with the legislative duties. On a field level, we have a concern with page 1, line 14 to page 2, line 1, regarding the which mandates the installation of interlocks on all vehicles for those arrested for DUI before the vehicle can be released from impound. We just wanted to point out to the committee that vehicle impound policies vary among the law enforcement agencies across the state. Some, such as Fairbanks, mandate that the vehicle be impounded on every case and that it be impounded for a specific amount of time. And then others actually encourage that the vehicle not be impounded for various reasons. So that section of the bill will have different effects across the state. Also, the more remote locations in the state, it's not uncommon to see wait times for the installation of these interlocks that can be 2 weeks or more. If this bill were to pass in its present format, that could mean that vehicles would be left in impound, accruing daily impound fees that, combined with the initial impound fee, could quickly add up to an amount that's greater than the value of the vehicle. Typically, when this happens, the impound agency, quote-unquote, gets stuck with the car, and we frequently see that across the state concerning abandoned vehicles. In the larger municipalities like Anchorage or the Mathew Valley, that's not necessarily a large concern as the vehicle has a scrap value. However, in smaller areas, more remote communities, and especially here in Southeast, a lot of times the cost to dispose of a vehicle is greater than the scrap value. So, for example, here in Southeast Alaska and Ketchikan, our local impound agencies will not impound abandoned cars for us. We actually have to go through the borough and find a different way to dispose of those vehicles because they essentially won't make any money on them. So a potential concern is that this could affect law enforcement in that the individuals arrested for a DUI, they're either slow in coordinating an interlock installation or there's a delay in getting a qualified technician to make this, and these impound fees add up to the point where they just say, it's not even worth getting my car out. And then we have a case where the impound agency is not too happy with the law enforcement agency for basically sticking them with a car. We also have a potential concern with the bill as presently written in that if the vehicle cannot be released until the ignition interlock is installed, then that technically might mean that device must be installed on the impound lot versus a mechanic shop. And we just wanted to point out that that's likely to cost significantly more for the individual and be problematic in the middle of winter or in poor weather. I did a little research on the ignition interlock device and the providers that install that device across the state. And currently there are 6 providers that provide that service. At least 5 of those will provide that service statewide. One, Alaska Monitoring and Drug Testing out of Fairbanks, actually has 22 off-road communities where they currently have procedures set up to make that happen. In some of the smaller locations, in fact, they mentioned to me they had 2 that they needed to install in Naknak, that it's one of those things where they will contract with a local mechanic or somebody that's qualified to do that, and that installation will take place. So these can be installed statewide, but what these agencies are telling me is that in some cases this can take several weeks to make this happen. So we just wanted to go ahead and bring that before the board. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Thank you. And I recall when we had the ignition interlock device bill before us discussing some of those issues that you just mentioned. So hopefully we've moved forward with a little more timeliness, but obviously we still have those issues. Representative Gruenberg, your question?
My question, Madam Chair, and I don't know if it's the same along the same request you made to the commissioner. If we could have a synopsis, maybe a bullet point or something, on your testimony, one page or less, for the record, it would be helpful to me. That's the lieutenant.
Sure. Representative Gatto and then Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lieutenant Dial, has there ever been any consideration for allowing an impounded vehicle to be impounded by a garage that installs interlocks and have the garage receive the vehicle, install the interlock, and then make it available for pickup by a member of the family or actually by the offender.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I'm not aware of that. I would suspect that most impound agencies would not be amenable to that for the main reason that as long as they have physical control of the vehicle, they feel they're going to get paid. If they release it to a third party, and then at that point, that's not a certainty anymore. So just in working with these impound agencies over the years, I would suspect that they wouldn't be amenable to that. I don't know that for sure, but I've never seen a case where a vehicle has been taken directly to a shop for installation.
Yeah, as a follow-up.
Follow-up?
Lieutenant, I didn't, what I was thinking was I didn't expect the garage to release the vehicle without being paid. I just thought that as a matter of ease and convenience and whatnot, for maybe a first-time offender that has to have an interlock installed, to not send it to an impound lot, especially if the impound lot is 300 miles from where they live. That's a different offense than if it's 30 feet from where a person lives. So if it would be possible to have the vehicle moved to the nearest place to the person's home, where, because the intent is the interlock device getting installed. The impound fee is a consequence that may be easy on some people and more difficult on others. And so what you're telling me is there never has been any consideration in this direction.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I have never seen any. No. Okay.
And just a comment, my personal thought on that is I wonder if I was asking the same question you just asked, I wonder if it would make a difference to me if it was my family member that had been involved in an alcohol-related accident, just how far away that offender's car was taken. That's just, I don't know, some personal reflection. Representative Lynn?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would assume that, at least number-wise, if not percentage-wise, numbers-wise, there are far more cases of DUIs where vehicles impounded in the urban areas than in the rural areas, because obviously there are more cars and more drivers here. But I'm wondering, would it be constitutional? And I know you're not an attorney, nor am I, but could you say these stricter standards would apply to, say, only to communities 20,000 to 30,000 or larger, and smaller communities could be excused because it's just not, may not be practical? That's probably more of a legal question than anything else.
Madam Chair?
Representative Groenberg.
I don't know, and we have Mr. Svobodny here, but I think that's a very valid legal question on the basis of equal protection.
That's what I'm thinking.
So I don't think it's I think it's a question that needs answer.
And I believe we will get an answer at the appropriate time. Commissioner Masters, I'm assuming you probably don't wish to answer that since it really doesn't follow under your bailiwick.
Through the chair, I was assuming the question probably was to me, but I don't have the expertise to answer it. I appreciate that.
All right, thank you. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We covered this several years ago, and we thought about a person living in Metlakatla, Kodiak, places off the road system, and we didn't know for sure whether or not a company would be willing to travel there, and it turned out they would. But you're paying their airfare, carrying all their equipment, certification in a remote area, and then everything back again. And there came the question where an individual on a remote location would pay a small fortune for an interlock device. So, and Representative Gruenberg probably knows, I think we excluded them, that they did not have to install the interlock device. But if you were available on the road system, then you qualified. So we went through that at some length, and that's the conclusion that we reached.
Representative Herron.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The lieutenant brings up a very good point, is when I was a city manager, inventory and inventory storage was always a problem. And it got so bad that the local impound firm, he'd cherry pick, and so I think that this based upon inventory storage, I think he brings a good point.
Madam Chair.
Lieutenant Dial, did you wish to comment on any of those latest statements, or hopefully you're still with us?
Madam Chair, I am. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I really don't have any comments.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg and then Representative Lynn, question?
I'll yield if I can have the question after him.
Sure. Representative Lynn.
I'd asked earlier, Lieutenant Dial, about what is the 2010 type field test. I assume that's pretty much the same as it's been since we've been doing these things, you know, touching nose, walking the line, et cetera. But what is a typical station test? When you get back to the station, is it breath? Is it blood? Et cetera. What do you typically do when they bring the suspect back to the station where you presumably have more equipment available?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, currently, once the individual is placed under arrest for DUI, they're brought back to the station. The first test that they're asked to take is a breath test, a test of the breath. Currently, most of the instruments in the state are the DataMaster style units. If they refuse to take that test, they're read the implied consent law of the state of Alaska. Most of the time, if they initially refuse, we can convince them to take the test by telling them that if they refuse to take the test, in addition to the DUI, they will also face a refusal charge. So instead of one charge, they now have two. Regardless of whether they take that breath test or not, they are given a right to have an independent test of their level of intoxication, and that current test is a blood test. So they are given the opportunity to have either a blood test at their own expense, at which if they had that, they would get to retain that sample, or a blood test at the state expense, at which point we would have a medical professional draw two tubes of blood, and they would be put into a evidence kit, and then that kit would actually be submitted to the crime lab for analysis.
Follow-up?
I assume there have been great advances in breathalyzers since the time I was doing that in the late 50s. It was just basically a funnel-type thing with a tube down the machine. Have there been tremendous advances since those old days, or where it's more practical, it's easier?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, there have been significant advances just in the 20 years that I've been a trooper. I can tell you that the instruments that we use nowadays have fail-safe checks that are conducted before the test is administered and actually after the test is administered, and they also test for the presence of interfering substances. So they're very technical anymore. They're constantly calibrated, and we do verify those calibrations on a routine basis in coordination with our local crime lab. So very accurate instruments.
Thank you very much. I'd like to see it someday.
Thank you. Representative Gruenberg.
As a visitor.
We can arrange that, Representative.
Are you providing the drinks?
In committee.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like you to look at the language bottom of page 1 and top of page 2, and I'm kind of serving a notice to Mr. Svobodny, too, because maybe a lot of these questions ought to be answered by him. Let's say you have a party going on, and two buddies are there drinking, or it could be in a bar, and each of them drives, and they both get drunk as a skunk, and they realize there's a chance that they'll be picked up, and they don't want to have their car impounded with an interlock. What would prevent person A from driving person B's car, person B from driving person A's car, and then neither one would be liable under this statute because neither was driving a car that was owned or registered to that person?
On that point, it might be too drunk to figure that scheme out.
That's kind of a rhetorical question we can pass on, but I'm just questions, really.
I think that's a good question to...
Yeah, and then... The next question is, we have a lot of joint ownership of cars, and What is the experience of the department where a husband and wife have, it's John or Jane, typical joint tenancy in the vehicle. And here, we have a family car, and Jane happens to be the drunk as a skunk, and John has to take the kids to school, etc. And it, maybe it should have the interlock installed, but the question is you can't release the car until it does, and maybe the family can't afford that. Any experience in the department or in police departments around in dealing with families in that type of crisis in this situation?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, if that question is directed at me, I can say that as of January of last year, courts have been requiring that those convicted of DUI have an ignition interlock installed as a general rule on every vehicle that they own, even if that happens to be work vehicles. And that's actually was based on conversations I've had with the district attorney's office. So really, they're given an order to do that. Now, on some occasions, they know that is not being completed because there's really no means to verify that that has been done at present time. So they're essentially, they're given the sentence, they're told that they must have these devices installed on their vehicles. Some could theoretically choose to sell their cars, transfer ownership. Some will have them completed and some just won't do it. But that's kind of our policy now, is that the courts will tell the individual that it's required to be installed on all their vehicles.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Lieutenant Dow, are you going to be able to remain online with us?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will remain online.
All right, great. Next, we have Douglas Moody, who's with the Public Defender's Office. Douglas, would you like to identify yourself and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony?
Madam Chair, I'm Deputy Public Defender. I'm actually here just to answer questions.
Okay. That's fine.
I don't know whether anybody has any.
Representative Grunberg has one for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, when you go to law school, they give you hypotheticals. And hypotheticals drive law students and observers of that sport crazy.
And committee people.
Yep. So what I'm wondering, I've given some hypotheticals as a devil's advocate here for problems with the bill. Do you have anything you want to add as another hypothetical just to get the people thinking and going crazy early in the afternoon?
Oh, God.
Error.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, no, I don't have anything to offer.
Thank you, Mr. Moody.
if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes, you may.
The issue I was concerned about, and I won't get into the Gatto Amendment at that time. This time, that's not before us. But with respect to Section 1 of the bill, do you see any due process problems there? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. Frankly, I haven't. I haven't thought about the due process considerations of this bill. Director Quinn Steiner would have been here, except he and his wife had a baby this week. But off the top of my head, you know, it's my job to think of due process problems with statutes when on my client's behalf. You know, there is, the courts generally have pretty broad leeway to require restrictions as part of bail conditions. Where that line is, I couldn't tell you at this point without doing some fairly extensive research. So I'm not prepared at this point to tell you where that line is.
Mr. Moody, you have time to think about that because we'll be having this bill before us a couple more times. So if you would please consider that and give it some thought, and also pass our congratulations on to the Steiner family. We're pleased for them and look forward to having him online next time. And then, Representative Grunberg, maybe you could, before the next meeting, send an email with some of your hypotheticals to Mr. Moody, and you guys could kind of do some little role-playing type thing there that could be presented to the committee, so we're prepared, and he has the opportunity to think about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we'll copy the baby.
Perfect. All right. Next, I have Wendy Hanneman and with the Public Advocacy Office. Wendy, I don't know if you're signed up to testify or just for questions.
I am not signed up to testify. I am here for questions on behalf of the Office of Public Advocacy if there are any questions for us regarding the bill.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg has a question for you.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair. We would also like, what we'll do in our email is address it to both of you, if that's okay.
Through the Chair, that would be fine, Representative Grunberg. I'm happy to, with the public defenders, do some research on those issues.
Yeah, and I think, with the Chair's permission, we may include some of these practical issues that we've addressed with the Department of Public Safety, and I, through the Chair, would like to invite, if the Department of Public Safety wants to amplify any of their answers to these things. It's awfully unfair to witnesses. I apologize that we ask all these questions, and, you know, who could anticipate them? So,
right. And I would ask that everyone who's sending these emails back and forth, the committee members, if they would please include Representative Hawker's office on this so that they can come, you know, prepared and have an opportunity. And they can include Representative Ramirez, who is the chair of this committee, and they will circulate to all members of the committee. So
we could send directly if you want.
You're welcome to do that.
Let's do that.
That's fine.
So everybody gets it.
Okay. So next I have Carrie Hennings from DMV. Carrie, I don't know if you're signed up to testify or questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Carrie Hennings, Driver's License Manager with Division of Motor Vehicles, and I'm just here for questions today.
Wonderful. I don't see any questions for you, but I'm hoping that as we I'm incorrect. Representative Grunberg has a question for you.
Ms. Hennings, is there any provision for putting on a person's driving license if they are not allowed to drive without an ignition interlock? Is there a space to put that on a driver's license?
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, there is. When we receive a court order to that they are restricted to an ignition interlock device.
So through the Chair, so right now, if I have a requirement to have a device on my car, do you automatically put that on the driver's license?
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, we do. When we receive the judgment, we put a restriction on the driver's license, and when they come in to reinstate, they're required to show proof of installation before we'll give their driver's license, reinstate their privileges.
Thank you. If I may follow up. I was just talking with an assistant attorney general on another subject, and it dealt with the antitrust laws. And under the laws of certain other states, clerks of, no, it's in the consumer protection law of this state, the clerk of the court is required to notify, I think, the attorney general in that case of certain things that are going on. And he said, Ed Sniffen said, that the clerks of the court don't do this. They don't follow the, I mean, they're just overloaded. And we had talked in the context of that other bill about who should have the responsibility of notifying, whether that should be the party themselves or whether you're going to put it on an overworked clerk of the court. And what I'm wondering is whether the legislature might change the responsible person there to the individual themselves so that if they get a judgment or an order or whatever, it's up to them to, number one, take a copy of that to you, and number two, get that put on their driver's license. That seems to me to be reasonable, and it shouldn't be on the poor clerk of the court. It should be on the individual. What do you think?
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, we have, I believe, so many drivers out of compliance. The honest people would come and report to us. Other people who just needed their driving privileges and didn't maybe have the resources to get the ignition interlock device or many other reasons may not report to us, and without notification We couldn't restrict the license, thus law enforcement wouldn't know of the requirement.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm going to think about that because that seems to me a very practical solution, and I'd kind of like the other folks in the audience. I see the commissioner has
he had another meeting.
Fled the jurisdiction.
He had another meeting.
Oh, okay. Excused. But maybe that's something we could think about because we want to be sure that that's on the license, and then if they're stopped for a taillight out or whatever, the policeman would see, you know, you're out of compliance. That's important if they're supposed to have it. They ought to.
Right. I would recommend you think
that.
About it and then talk with Representative Hawker because I don't know if this particular bill would be the right vehicle for that or a separate bill. But Representative Lynn.
Point.
Yes.
Madam Chair, this is Lieutenant Dial. Could I respond to that?
Yes.
I can say that currently the court is required within 5 business days to notify the DMV of an ignition interlock device requirement, and that is actually currently being annotated on the individual's Alaska Public Safety Information Network printout. So currently, as it stands right now, any person that has that requirement statewide, that information is going to show up when the officer conducts a traffic stop. And if we notice that the individual is driving a car and they have that requirement, we will charge them with violation of court order.
May I ask one follow-up?
Along with Representative Gatto, I'm on the Labor and Commerce Committee, and we're currently considering Reverend Holmes also, you know, the stripes on the driver's license for purchasing whiskey, and we were discussing that, and we might be able to integrate the two concerns. We just had that the last hearing. We'll probably have it the next hearing, and we probably need to talk about that. We can take
Good
up
point.
Two concerns at the same time.
Good point. Follow-up, Representative.
Yeah, just thank you, Madam Chair. If somebody, and this is going a little broader, if person A has a requirement for an ignition interlock order, and they go to another state and rent a car, is there any way the people in the other state would know that they're not supposed to drive without an ignition interlock? Through the chair.
Carrie, are you able to answer that question?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, on the face of the license is the restriction, which is a restriction C, and it's defined on the back of the driver's license as ignition interlock device required. A clerk at a rental car agency would have to carefully scrutinize the licenses, as we hope they are in our state.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Is there anyone else online that wishes to testify? All right, thank you. Mr. Svobodny, I know that you are here for questions, and there were many that brought up. Is your preference to make comments today, or would you prefer to wait till the next meeting, since so many things have been kind of thrown at you? What would you like? Come on forward. We always enjoy having you in our committee. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Rick Svobodny, and I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. I think the answers are yes, yes, maybe, and no.
Okay.
Now could we have the question?
There have been many questions asked for Rick. Is there anything specific that any member feels they need to get on record for him right now? Representative Gatto.
I'm sorry. It was a question for DMV.
Oh, no. Okay. Representative Gruenberg.
Madam Chair, I would say the same thing to you, Mr. Svobodny, that I don't know if you want to answer these questions now or in writing or whatever. I don't think we need to have them on the record at the moment. If you'd prefer to look over your notes and answer them in writing, what do you want to do? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, frankly, I didn't take notes of all the hypotheticals. Although your first one, the one I thought was real interesting, the answer is yes. That is, if the two people at the party took each other's car, then yes, they get away with not having the interlock device requirement. But I certainly, if you have a list of questions, I do have a Let me address one, because it was one that actually I came having thought about a little bit, and that is the Section 1, the bail provision. And you had asked the question if there was a violation of due process. I think the answer to that is no. There is, I think there is an argument of whether there's an equal protection violation. I don't think there is. I've given it some thought, and I've actually looked at Williams versus State, and for the lawyers, that's 151 Pacific Second 460. And that's a case where the legislature prohibited a person charged with a crime of domestic violence from returning to the home.
Mm-hmm.
And the Court of Appeals said that that was a violation of equal protection. And they went through an analysis that said that basically a marital relationship or relationship with other people, especially when it involved your home, was subject to special scrutiny by the court, and that there were no standards imposed. This seems to me to be a different, and at first blush I thought, well, how do you distinguish it from requiring an interlock device? And it doesn't have those special rights. It is a privilege to drive, not a right to drive. So it is not the same liberty interest like there is in who you associate with, or who you marry, or where you live. So I think that's distinguishable. I think that presently today, the courts in setting bail, given a particular fact circumstance, can prohibit a person from driving. That's certainly more, and they do, as a condition of bail, and that's certainly more onerous than saying you can drive, but you're going to have an interlock device. So I had thought of the issue, and I have come to the conclusion, and only looking at two cases, but I think it is a constitutional provision.
Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Yeah, I had thought of another issue that I forgot to mention to the folks from public safety, but it really is more your issue. And it deals with the scope of a permissible search. Normally, when they stop you for a traffic stop, there are restrictive rules on what they can search. If they're impounding the car for your DWI, will that constitutionally expand the scope of the permissible search? In other words, are we going to have a situation where somebody's pulled over for having more than the usual blood? They impound the car. Will that allow them to tear the car apart to search for anything they find?
And through the chair, Representative Grunberg, this bill doesn't affect that. I mean, police impound cars now so that they can be forfeited. And the impound search, and what you're talking about is an impound search, which
right.
is an exception to a search requirement, but the impound search is only for identifying items in the car to protect the police from an accusation that property's gone missing. So, they can do that search, gathering up your valuable belongings or identify by them now when your vehicle's impounded, either as a piece of evidence or for forfeiture.
May I follow up?
Yes, you may.
Here, though, you're almost making the installer an agency of the police, are you not? Because they're following the law and acting as part of the law enforcement agency's responsibilities here. Will that have any effect? Because they're going to do some tearing apart of the car, or installing the car, doing something to get the device installed. Will that change their legal status, and will that at all have any effect on what they can seize and ultimately use in evidence?
Well, through the chair, I think the question of what the practice is about who does an inventory search now is probably better directed to Lieutenant Dial. I don't know if the police agencies are just turning it over to the impound yard, and the impound yard's doing the search, or the police are doing a search to protect themselves if something goes missing in the impound yard. I don't envision this bill. I don't think this. I don't want to speak for the sponsor, but I don't think he envisioned forcing some type of mechanic to impose a interlock device without the defendant's permission.
And can I just add, in my discussions with the maker of this bill, that is my understanding also, that that is not his intention in any way, shape, or form, and this bill would actually kind of take on a whole different flavor if we were to start going that way. So might be something you want to have an offline discussion with Representative.
Yeah, maybe
Popper,
in our emails. I think I'm sure you're both right. So it's just saying you don't get the car back if you don't have it. It's not saying they have to do it. Okay, that certainly makes it somewhat different. Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, great.
I would, Madam Chair, mention one thing, other thing that I know what it was asked about, but for the person who has possession of the vehicle that's going to be returned, the last paragraph on the first page prohibits them from doing that, and there's really no sanction. So if somebody is to the agency who's released, it prohibits an agency from releasing the vehicle unless there's the impound the interlock device installed. There's no sanction to that. I don't know that there needs to be. There's no criminal sanction. I don't know whether there needs to be, because I think that there certainly would be smart civil lawyers would be saying, well, there's a civil mm-hmm. liability mm-hmm. that you're creating by not doing that. I don't know, again, whether that was an intentional decision in the drafting or not.
Right. Well, I've been watching Representative Hawker's staff take notes as everyone has been speaking, and all the members, I'm confident there's going to be several email exchanges going back and forth between the sponsor's office and this committee, so we'll be farther and better prepared to ask you substantive questions next time. So I want to thank you for being with us. And unless any members of the committee wish to put anything else on record today on this committee bill, what I'd like to do is to set it aside at this moment. Is that acceptable to members?
Absolutely.
All right. So, the sponsor's representative would like to state one more thing. Please come forward.
For the record, Julie Lucky from Representative Mike Hawker's office. And there were just a couple of other issues that had come out, and I wanted to just put them on the record in regard to the ignition interlock. One of the questions Representative Grunberg had asked was about trading the cars. And to be perfectly frank, Madam Chairman, our first bill had a requirement that the interlock device be required to be put on the car, whether or not you owned it. And the drafter had some constitutional questions about that. So therefore, the draft that we introduced did say you had to own the car. So, of course, if you did trade the car or drove someone else's car, that car would not have that requirement. There are a few other items that I'd like to bring up just rather quickly as far as things that should be considered. There is a list compiled by the DMV of places that do not have to have the interlock installed for existing law. Mm-hmm. That would not apply to our law, because that does not apply to the bail condition. So that is something that should be considered by the committee. In addition to the process, obviously there has been some discussion about, do installers get to go on the lot of the impound? How does that work? It's not the sponsor's intent to leave cars in impound. It was the sponsor's intent to put the kind of most basic idea forward, but that will be a process that we were hoping the Judiciary Committee would kind of figure out. Is that something that we release it as long as you have a note from the installer that you have an appointment to get it done? Is that, you know, can there be something back and forth to prove that you have the intent? Do you sign an affidavit saying you have the intent? Because as the bill stands, it does say you cannot release it, which would put the onus on the impound lot to then keep the car, and also the civil liability on the impound lot. That is not our intent. However, it was our intent to put forth a fairly basic bill so that we could discuss these issues on the record. Another thing that I would like to bring up is that our current interlock statutes after conviction do say that you can reduce the amount of fines that are required to pay for the interlock. That does not apply to the bail, because there would, of course, be no fines upon conviction. So therefore, that is something that we would like to bring up. I don't know if the courts have the ability to reduce the amount of bail to pay for. I'm not quite sure how the bail works, and that is something else that we would like to bring up as an item of discussion, is if a person cannot afford to have the interlock device installed in the car, since there is no fine payable because there is no conviction, how would that be handled? And that is something else that Representative Hawker was hoping that the Judiciary Committee could think about and figure out what an equitable way of dealing that is. Another thought that we would like to put out there is some concern about requiring interlocks on the first offense for bail, and the committee should consider whether, since our intent is to get out repeat offenders, whether that bail condition be only put on second offenders, which would also reduce the amount of problems that we would have with impound, because it's my understanding that majority of offenders do not go on for a second conviction, and we're hoping to get a little bit more of that statistical information. But that would also reduce the numbers of cars we're talking about and the numbers of people who are affected. And that also, I think, passes a better constitutional test, in that a second offender is more likely to be shown if a bail condition can be put forth for protection of the community, in addition to for having somebody appear in court. And I'm going to say I'm not a lawyer. I just play one in the legislature, so that may be something that's better asked about the courts. But that's my understanding, whether or not it is more equitable to require an interlock device for only somebody who has a second offense. Okay. And so those were just some of the issues that have also come up, just so that we could get those on the table, and that are, I guess, sticky wickets for the committee to deal with, that we're hoping to have thoughts on in our email exchanges that happen.
And great. Thank you, Julie. We appreciate it very much. And I notice the Department of Court System is here. Maybe if we could ask you, Doug, to, you don't need to come forward, but if you could just be prepared next time to comment on the bail situation that was just brought forward, that would help us greatly. So with that, we're going to set House Bill 271 aside. And those that came just for that, if you wish to leave, you are welcome to, but if you wish to stay, we welcome that also. We are going to take up next House Bill 144, which is, thank you. This bill has already made it through Labor and Commerce, Judiciary is its last committee of referral. Pertaining to probate code, wills, trusts, non-probate, transfers, etc. And Jane, if you would like to introduce yourself and your affiliation, we'd like to move forward.
Thank you, Chair Dahlstrom. My name's Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Ramirez. And House Bill 144 will keep Alaska in its front-runner position as one of the premier states for trusts and estate plannings. This has been one of a series of bills that originated here in 1992 and started passing through the legislature, which have really kept Alaska as a premier place for trust, wills, and estates, bringing outside money as well as Alaskans' money and keeping it within the state. House Bill 144 provides the following amendments to the Uniform Probate Code to facilitate the administration of wills and trusts. It adds provisions allowing the settlor of a trust to designate a representative who can bind an incapacitated person in future proceedings relating to trust administrations, and this will help streamline the process. It wouldn't always require a guardian ad litem. It established an augmented estate that does not include property transferred to an irrevocable trust if the settlor is a discretionary beneficiary of the trust and the transfer was made more than 30 days before marriage or the consent of the descendants or with the consent of the decedent's spouse. The provision is similar to statutory provisions adopted in Delaware. And an augmented estate consists of property owned by both a deceased person and his or her spouse. Its value is calculated only if a surviving spouse declines whatever he or she is left by will and instead claims a share of the decedent's spouse estate taking against the will. And the statutory amount depends on law. It did come out in the last committee that in Alaska it's one-third of the combined estate, and it's called the widow's election. House Bill 144 creates a procedure, and this is sort of a really interesting, different way to look at things, and I think it's great. establishment a will and trust validity before death, so you can basically probate your will before death and have it validified. Situations arise where there is a question concerning a person's capacity to execute a will or a trust and whether the document was executed as the result of undue influence, duress, fraud, or mistake. And the new procedure will allow these issues to be brought before the court while the testator and settlor are still alive and the evidence is fresh. And it's similar to provisions allowed in three other states. And it also provides for a venue for a probate proceeding if the decedent is not domiciled in Alaska, but significant assets are located in the state. And I can go through what the different sections do if you want, but that's pretty much what the bill does.
That's fine. Several members of the committee sit on Labor and Commerce, and I know heard this bill last year. I sat in on it, was discussed very thoroughly. I have one person online to testify. Are there questions for Jane right at the moment? Or we all know she's not going to run away. She's staying with us. All right. Beth Chapman, are you still with us online? Oh, wonderful. Welcome, and please identify yourself and your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you. My name is Beth Chapman. I'm an attorney in private practice in Juneau, Alaska, where I have practiced in the trust and estates area for the past 22 years. I want to first thank all of you for considering this bill and all the bills that have been passed by the legislature, as it has allowed us to more cost-effectively and efficiently advise our clients, both non-Alaskans who bring money to the state and also Alaskans, to better plan for their families. I support this bill. I'm also a member of the informal group of trusts and estates attorney that work on these bills, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
All right. Thank you, Beth. Are there any questions from members? Representative Herron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Beth, we have this bill that's going through. Is there any – it's an opportunity to do some other tweaks. Is it – you think of any?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, every day I face a new situation that I thought I would never see in the trust and estates area. But as of the moment, I believe that this particular bill does not need any additional tweaks to it. In particular, the pre-death probate procedure, I believe, will be very effective in reducing litigation among families.
Thank you.
Perfect. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dave Schaftel and I talked about this at great length over the interim. I can't find my notes. This is by memory. Okay. On page 4, it states that the person representing the other person is not liable to the beneficiary or anybody who's a potential plaintiff for an action or omission made in good faith. That only imposes, it's almost a total immunity section, as long as the person is not acting in bad faith. How about if they're acting recklessly or negligently in any manner? Why don't we simply have the normal standard? Why should, you know, I'm a lawyer, and people have made claims against my law firm for because they didn't like their divorce results or whatever else occurred in the circumstances. Why should the standard be different for trust lawyers? And if we do this, why can't I put in a bill immunizing my specialty next year, and criminal law the following year, business law the following year? Aren't we going down a slippery slope here?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the standard of good faith in this provision does not apply. It's not applicable to trust and estates attorneys. It's applicable to anyone who is representing another beneficiary in a trust matter. If it's an attorney that's representing that beneficiary, they're still going to be held to their professional standards. What we're talking about is a situation where the trust settlor may say, that one sibling is going to be the representative of the other sibling in all trust matters, maybe because one sibling is unable to actively participate for a variety of reasons. In that circumstance, we're asking that individual to take on a role in saying, as long as you're acting in good faith, and which is a standard that we use when we talk about trustees' actions as well. If you read the restatement third of trust, good faith is the first standard that we apply to whether they're fiduciaries or non-fiduciaries. This does not absolve trust and estates attorneys of their professional responsibility.
May
in any
I follow
manner.
Up, please? Follow up. It helped me if I can just follow up. Okay. That works under that hypo. I'm satisfied. But if the person who is, quote, designated to represent the other, could that not be a bank or something that's a professional institution? I mean, I have, you know, in my recollection from the limited guardianship stuff I've done, is there's a provision to have somebody serve without bond, for example. And that's the circumstance where you got one sibling representing the family, which we had when my mom died. And I can see it in that kind of a circumstance. But suppose the person, quote, person, was a bank or a trust department or something. Why should they have that immunization?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it's the nature of the representation that we're focusing on, not necessarily who the individual is. And even if it were a bank, when we have bank service trustees, there is always a threshold of good faith. Good faith does not, in the trust and estates area, if they have somebody has the discretion, then what the court is looking at is not second-guessing them, and that is what the good faith standard means in this context.
Through the chair.
Follow-up?
Is good faith in this sense a standard of due care? Is it a term of art? Because normally I would read good faith as whether somebody's acting in good faith, and that's, you know, my recollection is the court normally construes terms according to their ordinary and accepted meanings, and they don't look even at Black's, they look at Webster's. Is that a term of art that's defined somewhere, Ms. Chapman, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I'm not aware of it being defined in the Alaska statutes. I am aware of court decisions as well as the restatement third of trust, which is mm-hmm. where we look to
right.
for guidance in trust interpretation matters. And there has been the use of the term good faith has been defined, and it is a reasonableness standard. It's acting in the best interest of the person to whom you are representing. And so I try to give an example, maybe that...
Well, maybe I can cut this short.
Follow up?
Yeah, I have two areas I am focusing on today.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first, and I'd like to talk with Ms. Chapman and look at these authorities and put it on the record or something so that we know that, you know, this is just exactly what she's saying here.
Okay, when you say talk with her, what are you requesting?
Well, maybe till Monday or something.
My intent, I would like to move this bill from committee today. If we took a 5-minute break and you talked privately, would that?
Yeah, maybe 5 or 10 minutes. Let me
no,
tell you.
No, not 10. We need to end right at 3 o'clock. Other folks have meetings, so.
I see.
Let's
Let me go on to my second issue, then.
Pertaining, a total different subject.
It's in the bill.
All right, yeah. Representative Grunberg.
Just so I can put on the record what my concerns are. It's on page 10, line 6. And these are the things that have to be in a petition to have a will declared valid under that pre-death provision. And it says it must be signed by two individual witnesses. And I'm wondering, should there be a provision in there that says that these individuals are people, quote, who are not beneficiaries of the will, unquote, or who are, quote, disinterested parties, so we don't have somebody getting, you know, a sweetheart deal here.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, this is referring to the requirement under our general probate code that's been in existence since statehood, where if a will is in fact witnessed, and recall, a will does not need to be witnessed to be valid in this state. But if a will is witnessed to make itself proving, those witnesses do not need to be disinterested and, in fact, can be beneficiaries of the will under current state law. Mm. And that is the generally recognized rule throughout the country.
Okay, I will accept that. The other question I think we could probably do, and I'll do it as quickly as possible, hopefully in 5 minutes, but
let's aim for 5 minutes. Thank you, Representative Barber.
Okay. Maybe we could talk and you show me what you're talking about.
Okay, and let me just ask a question. Is your expectation then to come back and put everything on record?
Yeah.
Then why don't we just do the 5 minutes online?
Oh, I don't mind.
Why don't we do that? Is that all right?
Yeah, okay. It may be a little informal in my dialoguing directly.
Please
okay.
Proceed.
So, Beth, tell me, I want to be sure that the definition of good faith is really clear in here. Anyway, you're shaking your head.
I'm sorry. Ms. Pierce was asking me if I wanted a copy of the statute, and I was shaking my head. No. Through the chair, if I may, Representative Groomberg, there is no definition of good faith in the Alaska statute. It is a standard that is used, and it may well be used in other provisions of the trust code. I don't recall off the top of my head, but it is a standard that we use when we are looking at, for example, a trustee's actions. And did that trustee act in good faith when making a decision if they have the discretion to make, for example, a distribution? And the way that the courts have been looking at the good faith standard is, have they been acting reasonably, and it allows the court to assess the conduct of the trustee but not to second guess. So it's almost of an abuse of discretion standard.
Okay, but there's a standard of reasonableness involved?
Yes, there is under the Restatement Third of Trust.
Are you intending here that the term good faith would be as defined in the restatement?
I can't answer that off the top of my head without looking at the restatement to give you a provision, but I believe that the intent is to ensure that when we have somebody represent another individual in any trust proceeding, that we're not imposing liability that one would call, I guess, almost rise to a level of strict liability where you can come in and second guess.
Oh, no.
We all make decisions, and of course we can all be second guessed on everything that we do, and someone can come to a different conclusion. It's not going to absolve somebody of somebody who, if they act negligently or unreasonably, what we're asking of them is to say, are you acting in the manner that you're looking out for the other individual? And that's the court standard that we're going to ask to be applied.
Is there any chance that this language as it stands could be misinterpreted in the manner that I have misinterpreted?
Through the chair, Representative Groomberg, no. And I can tell you I'm currently representing a trustee in a trust litigation manner where this good faith standard was in the trust document, and the court has already issued some rulings on it. And nobody took the position, including me, that it would allow somebody to escape liability. Instead, it was the abuse of discretion is making sure that nobody is second-guessing what they're doing, but rather looking at it from the lens of the individual who's making the decision.
I am mindful of the chair's desire to move the bill and the sponsor. I support the bill. This was and I'm going to see if I find my notes, and if so, I'll be in touch with you. But this bill has got a ways to go. Mm-hmm. And rather than making any more of it at this point, Ms. Chapman, I'd like you to set it, you two, with Ms. Staff, to set a time that we can talk. And I may want to do an amendment or a letter of intent down the line. I just don't want some judge in Anchorage or anywhere else, I'm not going to say out in the Tulies or anything like that, because that's not the case, but some judge who's not familiar with this, who's only been a divorce lawyer, to to make sure that this term, which is absolutely at the heart of this litigation in some cases, I'm sure, to make sure it's interpreted the way that Ms. Chapman has intended. I don't want him to have to look back on the January 29, 2010 meetings of the House Judiciary Committee to do that. And with that, and with the permission of the committee,
I will not object to moving the bill, but I think we do want to be darn sure that there's no question. This was an issue my staff first brought to my attention, and I think she's right on.
Great, and I would encourage you to work with the sponsor on the bill on that letter of intent, and that can be included. So,
yeah, or a floor amendment or something there in the next house, but
right,
please work with us on this. I want to just put down what you say, but let's make sure that nobody misunderstands.
All right, with that, Representative Gatto?
I have a question for Ms. Chapman. Just for ordinary people, let's say Mr. X goes out and buys a copy of software, pays $40. It's from a recognized company. It looks good. He fills it out online, prints it, has a printed copy, and it's filled out except for a signature. He has to go to a notary and get his signature witnessed, or he can just sign it and file it. And what's the procedure?
Through the chair, if it is a printed version of a document, then it will not need to be notarized, but it has to have the two witnesses. If you handwrite a will in your own handwriting, or the material portions are in your own handwriting, you can sign it, and you do not need to have witnesses, and you do not need to have it notarized.
Terrific. Thank you. Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Gatto.
Question over across the hall there.
Representative Groenberg.
I would like to put on the record something we talked, Dave and I talked about. You have a circumstance where you have a hearing prior to the death, and I went through this in the context of a divorce. And you have the hearing, and the judge has the person there and their lawyer, and the judge makes a decision that the person is of sound mind and body and knows what they're doing and gives all the money to Ajax, the grandchild, but not to Betelgeuse, who's not around. Person dies. Betelgeuse then sues and says, you know, it's not res judicata or collateral estoppel or any of those legal terms. It's not binding on me because I didn't have a right to participate. Tell me what result, Ms. Chapman, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Groenberg, notice has to be provided to all heirs of the individual whose will is being probated before death. I'm going to have to use that term. But and so if they are not provided adequate notice in accordance with the statutes, it would not be binding on them.
Through the chair. Suppose it's not an heir that challenges it, but it's the American Red Cross and says, you know, that Mr. Decedent Duck has died now, and they promised us we'd get their $1 million. What issue preclusion is there in that circumstance?
Through the chair, Representative Groenberg, if the American Red Cross had not been named in the will, meaning that they're not a devisee under that will, they would have no standing to challenge a will.
Oh, okay.
Unless they can produce maybe potentially a contract to make a will, but
understood.
Not likely that they would have standing in.
And finally, one other question that I think I discussed with Mr. Shaftel. It talks about venue in a probate proceeding if the decedent wasn't domiciled here, but significant assets are located within Alaska. Will that mean there'll be dual probate, or how will that work? So we're going to have competing probates in here and in California.
Through the chair, Representative Groenberg, we already have multiple probates that can occur if there's property in a variety of states. Generally, one court will take the original jurisdiction, and this allows, consistent with the conflicts of laws provisions, for Alaska to take the original jurisdiction. If that is what the decedent had wanted.
So there's a body of law that already deals with this, so you don't have dueling jurisdictions here.
Through the chair, Representative Groenberg, that is correct.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
We had a lengthy conversation.
That was good, though. That was good. It's good to have on record. Representative Gatto.
Just a comment, and then I'll move the bill. This bill is complicated enough that I've decided not to die.
Good.
I'll witness
that. Decided not to die.
And you have a witness.
Other than that, Madam Chair, I'll move House Bill 144 from committee with individual recommendations. It appears to be zero physical notes. I'm sorry, one physical note and one physical note that a zero physical note.
All right, are there any objections?
All right. With that, this bill will, House Bill number 144, will move from committee, and we will adjourn. If members would please stay to sign the document, that would be great. And the time is 2:45. Thank you.
Nancy, thank you.
Thank you.